Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we discuss the two questions put to Massachusetts voters on the November ballot. We start with question one, motor vehicle mechanical data. According to the Information for Voters pamphlet distributed by Secretary of the Commonwealth William Galvin, a yes vote would provide motor vehicle owners and independent repair facilities with expanded access to wirelessly transmitted mechanical data related to their vehicle's maintenance and repair. A no vote would make no change in the law governing access to vehicles' wirelessly transmitted mechanical data. We've invited two parties listed in the Information for Voters pamphlet to join us to make their case in favor of question one is Tommy Hickey from Massachusetts Right to Repair. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
In opposition to question one is Connor Units from the Coalition for Safe and Secure Data. Connor, thanks for being with us. Connor, are you there? Right. Maybe Dan can work on getting Connor back. Because this initiative has raised questions about data security, we invited a professor well-versed in cybersecurity. Professor Stuart Madnick is the John Norris McGuire Professor of Information Technologies Emeritus at the MIT Sloan School of Management and the founding director of cybersecurity at MIT Sloan. Welcome, Professor Madnick.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
You bet. We want to hear from listeners, too. Do you have a question or a comment about question one? Give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's start with you, Tommy Hickey, from Massachusetts Right to Repair. Make the case for why voters should vote yes on this question.
Sure. So thanks again for having me. In 2012, Massachusetts voted a record-setting 86% in favor of the Right to Repair initiative. It is the highest-passing ballot initiative in Massachusetts history. We always joke you can't get 9 out of 10 people to agree on anything, but when it came to car repair choice, Massachusetts did speak. And what it did was mandate that car manufacturers give the same repair and diagnostic information to independent repair shops or local shops that they gave to their franchise dealers. What was happening is that independent repairers weren't getting all the proper information to fix a car and thus having to send that car to the dealership, which we know is about 30% more expensive than your local shop, meaning your local shop was losing business, but also the consumer was paying more and double to get their car repaired as having to go twice. So we passed that law for a level playing field, but more importantly, so the consumer can get their car fixed where they want. Fast forward 7 years, technology has obviously evolved in everything, and your car is no different. Your car is now a computer on wheels. There was a carve-out in the 2013 law for any wireless communications, typically this system called telematics. And telematics is like sensors in your car for your parts. It's like the health of a car system. Right now, car manufacturers are collecting real-time wireless diagnostic and repair information, pretty much bypassing the 2013 Right to Repair law because it was carved out, meaning your independent repair and you as the car owner do not have access to this. This ballot initiative will fill that void and update the Right to Repair law to give the owner direct access to all their wireless diagnostic repair information and allow them, with their authorization, to share that with an independent repair or dealership, because we do believe as a coalition, if you bought the car, you should all have all the access necessary to fix it.
So Tommy, specifically, what kind of data falls under the term mechanical data?
So this is just mechanical information necessary to diagnose, maintain, and repair the car, as stated in the language and the Attorney General summary. This is not GPS information. This is not personal information. In fact, I would say right now you plug into an OBD port to get that information. As the OBD port becomes increasingly less used as we move to a wireless society, we want that same information that goes to the OBD port that's now becoming wireless. And that's everything to fix the car, because we are a coalition of 1,600 independent repair shops, 40,000 jobs here in Massachusetts in the aftermarket, and all we want to do is fix cars today and fix cars tomorrow.
Tell me, what personal information about the vehicle is included in this? Does it include, you know, name, address, phone number, that kind of thing?
It does not. This is diagnostic and repair information that's coming through the OBD port that's now becoming wireless. It's the same information we get. It's just becoming wireless.
Mm-hmm. And so how much control do owners have over what data is made available and who can access that data?
So in terms of this ballot initiative, this would mandate that car manufacturers give direct access to owners on their mechanical information. That's the diagnostic and repair information that's currently going through the OBD port. In terms of what's being collected by their car, this initiative would mandate that car dealers give owners a one-pager on telematics and what's being collected. But again, this is a closed system the car manufacturers have created. So what they're collecting, what they're doing with that information, you would have to ask the car manufacturers. What we're after as a repair coalition is to make sure that owners can continue to get their cars fixed where they want, just like they voted for in 2012.
Evidently, we're having some trouble getting Connor Yudis from the Coalition for Safe and Secure Data on the line, so I know Dan's working on that. But in the meantime, Professor Madnick, you've noted that there are already cybersecurity risks that are associated with vehicles, particularly as they become more autonomous. So do you see any cybersecurity risks associated with this proposed motor vehicle mechanical data law?
Well, as Tommy already mentioned, cars are often viewed as computers on wheels. As we all know, computers can be hacked, and so can cars. In fact, even a few years back, it was demonstrated how a Jeep Cherokee could be hacked remotely. So there's always a risk whenever you provide access. And of course, as Tommy mentioned, there's all kinds of data being gathered. I don't know exactly the magnitude of all the data collected, obviously things like the engine operation and tire pressure. But it's also possible that within the car, access to, for example, your phone book is in the car. So whether it can be accessed remotely or not, I don't know. But particularly if it does exist, and it can be hacked, then it could be accessed. And of course, concern from a cybersecurity point of view, whenever you open up a new door, you provide a new opportunity for hackers. And that is the concern.
Professor Madnick, the imminent of calls for open access data platform, can you explain what that means and some of the risks associated with open access platforms?
Well, there's two parts. First, the notion of open access, as already explained by Tommy, is that right now this telematics, that is the data that's being gathered by your computer, can be sent over the airwaves to a receiver to analyze it and so on. So what this provides basically is a more flexible and, as he said, open. That means accessible not just by the manufacturers, but by access by others, presumably repair shops, but possibly others could access it at all. But I always like to caution people to realize, of course, when we talk about risk, everything we do involves some risk. Even getting out of bed in the morning is a risk. And, of course, driving in a car is a big risk. Yeah. So you need to weigh the benefits and risks whenever you make these decisions.
So is there a way to safeguard against hacking or unauthorized access?
Well, first, there's two issues there. It also depends how well designed the security for such an open access platform is. My concern is that rushing to add such features without careful testing and such, as I mentioned already, this Jeep Cherokee thing was not intended to be hacked. It just turned out there were oversights in the manufacturing process that made that possible. So one question in terms of this ballot question, and I don't know the answer, is how ready the manufacturers are to have a secured open access system ready by 2022, since car design and manufacturing often starts several years before they're launched. And then there's one more issue that doesn't get much coverage in the ballot question. It talks about the formation of this independent organization that manages the data. And I've not heard much about, whether they're ready to roll, so to speak, but also who and what this organization is and what is it that they can do with such data. And then finally, there's a question of how well securely this data is used, both by the repair shops but also by the car owners. As I often have noted, 50% of all home security cameras still have their default password. So will car owners be more attentive to who and how they authorize remote access? So these are the open questions that I have not seen fully studied.
Right. We've got Connor Yudis now from the Coalition for Safe and Secure Data. Connor, welcome. So, Connor, why are you and the Coalition for Safe and Secure Data urging voters to vote no on question one?
Sure. So first, it needs to be said again that this is not right to repair. We already have a right to repair law in Massachusetts. It works extremely well, and it covers everything necessary to diagnose and repair a car, including telematics if it's necessary to diagnose and repair a car. So this ballot question is completely unnecessary And as Professor Matnick just laid out, there are tons of unanswered questions about this. It's incredibly vague. The timeline is incredibly rushed. And there is virtually no way that this can safely be implemented on the timeline laid out in the ballot question.
So what kinds of personal data are you concerned could be made available to third parties as the proposed law is written?
Our primary concern is that once you open, what this would essentially do, and I just heard the reference to the Jeep Cherokee hack, it would essentially advance something like that exponentially, because it wouldn't require anyone plugging into the vehicle. It would only require a wireless access into this open access platform or into this mobile app. And once somebody with malicious intent gets into that computer and they have, you know, the unlimited time to kind of play around and poke around and get past whatever security systems are even in there, to the extent that there are them, because they're not laid out in this question, then they can get access to anything in that computer, GPS location and otherwise. So it's a question of basically any information that is stored in that car could become available to anyone with malicious intent.
Tommy, what are your thoughts on the questions that are being raised?
So I think the professor just said out loud, listen, when you get out of bed, there's a risk. Obviously, there's a cybersecurity risk in some capacity when you're talking about over-the-internet cars. That's happening right now. Car manufacturers are already using this technology. Car dealers are already getting this technology. So what you're talking about is already happening. And now what we're asking is car manufacturers to give owners their own diagnostic repair information. Let them be in charge of who gets this diagnostic repair information. There's no cybersecurity risk when you're talking about mechanical information to diagnose, maintain, or repair the car. We're not after GPS information. We're not after personal information. There should be an open and standardized platform for owners to get their diagnostic or repair information, but they should get nothing more, and that's not what we're after. We believe in our cybersecurity research that this can be done in a safe and secure way, just as the ballot language calls for, because we don't believe it's unnecessary. When Connor says that it's unnecessary and it's not a right to repair, which I may add, the title is an act to update and enhance the 2013 right to repair law. It's never unnecessary to give owners more information and more choice, allowing them to make informed decisions on their car repair choice, because this is what they voted for in 2012. And now we need to make sure that technology doesn't circumvent that law and allow them to get their car fixed where they want.
Connor, how do you respond to that?
I would say, first, on the point that they don't want GPS location, the only example we've seen of what this app, the mobile app that would be created by question one would look like, comes from the Auto Care Association, the client, you know, the main funder of Tommy's Coalition. They were going around last year and showing a prototype of what that app would look like, and that app included maps, it included location data, it included behavioral data. So when they say they don't want those things, they've proven otherwise as they've gone to talk to different customers around the country. So I want to make that point. Second, there is, as we just discussed, what really is the major thing at this point as we get closer to it is the timeline, because model year 2022 vehicles can begin being sold in January of 2021, and most of them will be rolled out by the spring or the fall of next year. It's simply not feasible to create this platform, create this entity, create this app. I mean, you think about Zoom, you know, how everyone's using Zoom calls now. Zoom has been around for years, and they still have all sorts of security flaws and hacks and penetrations. And somehow we're going to create an app within the next year that works with every single vehicle in Massachusetts and doesn't have security flaws? I mean, that just doesn't even make sense.
So, Connor, for voters who are concerned about their vehicle data getting into the wrong hands but believe that vehicle owners should be able to choose who repairs their vehicles, what are their options, and is there a way for this data to be shared with third parties in a safer manner?
There definitely is, and many automakers are already doing this on their own through their secure systems. For example, BMW has a car data program that they created because of cybersecurity rules in Europe as opposed to vehicle data rules. And they're rolling that out in the U.S. now. What that one does is it creates this app. It's a secure transmission through a secure server with encrypted, anonymized data that gets relayed not directly to the vehicle but through this app and then back to the consumer. And the consumer can look right in that app and see what third parties they want to share information with, including mechanics, and they can limit the information that those mechanics or any other third parties can see. So they are in total control. The biggest difference is that is, you know, a system that is secure, encrypted, anonymized that BMW has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in creating and securing, and it is completely different than an open access platform with standardized information or standardized access.
Tommy, what assurance can you give voters that if this ballot question passes, their vehicle data and personal data, including GPS information, will be safe and secure as it is now under the current law?
Because the proof is in the pudding. When you look at the actual language, what voters are voting on, it says mechanical information necessary to diagnose, maintain, and repair the car. You do not need GPS information for that. The car manufacturers are called to create this open and standardized platform, and we don't want GPS information to be in that. When Connor talks about these many automakers making their apps and giving their owners information depending on the automaker, that tells me two things. That can be done, so there is a way to get their owners safe and secure data. But more importantly, we cannot be at the automaker's mercy as Independent Repair Shop Coalition and Owner Coalition. Once again, you have automakers trying to be in charge, trying to keep independent repairers at their mercy. We need an open and standardized platform, which, by the way, which was the 2012 law, meaning that 26 different car manufacturers can create 26 different ways of fixing a car, pricing independent repairers out and forcing people into the dealership. You need to have a level playing field, which is 2012 law voted on. This is about getting your car fixed. There should be no cybersecurity risk when it comes to doing that, and car manufacturers are already doing this. Voting no means that car manufacturers will be the only entity that can collect this information, have access to it. They have a monetary interest in monopolizing this and giving it to their dealerships to force people in. Voting yes empowers you as a consumer to get all of this access, all of this diagnostic and repair information that's generated wirelessly, and mandate and dictate where that goes.
Professor Magnick, final word. When weighing concerns about cybersecurity and freedom of choice around who repairs your vehicle, what do you suggest voters keep in mind?
Well, first, there's no easy answer. As I said earlier, you must weigh the benefits and risks. Let me just say a little bit both on the benefit and the risk side. One example I was mentioned to me was a possibility with this wireless data. It's not just a matter of having your car fixed, but the car being able to notify your repair shop that the brakes are beginning to fail, not right away, but beginning to, and to advise you to come in for repair. So in other words, it can actually be much like monitoring your health on a constant basis. So there are lots of benefits this type of technology will have, especially as the computers on the cars become smarter and smarter, knowing what to do. But on the other hand, in terms of the risk, I always stress there's a big difference between what things are intended to do and what things are capable of being done. And time again, we find cyber attacks occur because somehow a system or device was made to behave in a way we had not expected. And that's the concern. You really need to study these things very carefully. And the thing I don't know is whether enough time and energy has gone in to making sure that the risk had been reduced significantly. So those are the weighing, and each person has to kind of balance that. You know, whether you get out of bed this morning or not, you've got to make a decision.
All right, Connor, since you joined us late, I'll give you the final word. Go ahead.
I just want to make clear that local independent mechanics are a critical part of the infrastructure of the repair market. They already do 70% of post-warranty work. They already have access to everything they need to diagnose and repair a car. That is not going to change no matter what the yes side says. This is not an attempt to keep repair shops out of the market. It's an attempt to protect consumer data.
All right, Connor Yunis from the Coalition for Safe and Secure Data, Tommy Hickey from Massachusetts Right to Repair, and Professor Stuart Madnick, John Norris McGuire, Professor of Information Technologies Emeritus at MIT Sloan School of Management and the Founding Director of Cybersecurity at MIT Sloan. Thank you all for being with us and taking time to share this with us. Coming up after break, question two, ranked choice voting. You're listening to The Point, and we're talking about the ballot questions that Massachusetts voters will be deciding this November, and we're moving on to question two, ranked choice voting. According to the Information for Voters pamphlet distributed by the Secretary of the Commonwealth, William Galvin, a yes vote would create a system of ranked choice voting in which voters would have the option to rank candidates in order of preference, and votes would be counted in rounds, eliminating candidates with the lowest votes until one candidate has received a majority. A no vote would make make no change in the laws governing voting and how votes are counted. And we should note that if passed, ranked choice voting would only apply to statewide offices, state legislative offices, and federal congressional offices. It would not apply to presidential elections or in races where more than one person is to be elected. First, we'll hear from the group organized in opposition to ranked choice voting. Then we'll talk with the group in favor, and we'll end the hour with a reporter from Maine Public Broadcasting to see how ranked choice voting is working in that state where voters approved it back in 2016. Joining us from the Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance, the group organized in opposition to ranked choice voting, is Paul Craney. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure. Paul, why is ranked choice voting not a good idea for Massachusetts?
Well, let me first say, my name is Paul Diego Craney. I'm the spokesperson of Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance. We are a organization based in Boston that holds lawmakers accountable to their voting record on taxes, spending, the budget, and transparency. With that said, ranked choice voting doesn't necessarily fit into those categories I just outlined. But the reason why I'm on your show and talking to the public is because there are some problems associated with ranked choice voting that I want to make sure the public knows about. And ranked choice voting is not a partisan issue. It's not a Republican or Democrat issue. It's not even an ideological issue, meaning liberal or conservative. Even though I happen to be more on the right of the political spectrum, everyone would acknowledge that the current system right now doesn't necessarily benefit, right of center candidates in Massachusetts. I mean, Republicans have a 10 to 15% minority in the legislature. So I'm not advocating for a system that benefits, let's say, the Republican side or the conservative side of the aisle. But I wanted to come on your show because I do believe in more choices is a good thing. I think if you listen to the advocates of ranked choice voting, you're going to hear some very noble things they're trying to solve. But I want to point your listeners to some of the problems, which I think are oftentimes overlooked. And in my personal opinion, the problems do not outweigh the benefit associated with ranked choice. The biggest issue I see is confusion. We want voting to be really simple, clear, and transparent. You don't want to add another layer of bureaucracy or confusion to the voters. I think I'm pretty politically savvy. I follow elections pretty closely. I follow ballot questions pretty closely. But I'll be honest with you, I have a hard time identifying every candidate, every election, which I think most people do. The pro-ranked choice voting will often point to the congressional primary that happened in the 4th congressional district where there was about 10 candidates running. They would say that makes a good case for ranked choice voting. The highest vote getter only got about 25% of the vote. What I would say is, a voter is going to be forced to research each candidate. That could be a noble thing. I think that's a good thing. But the problem is that the average voter is not going to do that. I know that because I feel like I wouldn't do that. They're going to have to identify each voter, come to a determination to rank each one. And here's the problem with ranked choice voting. The main problem with it, in my opinion, is that if you don't pick two candidates that are standing at the end, then your vote eventually gets discarded from picking the eventual winner of the contest. And that's called voter exhaustion. Ranked choice voting is built on that. That's the only way you get to the selection process is by discarding votes. And so a lot of people have problems with that. And the other thing that's really confusing is overvoting. And what that simply means is you go to the ballot, and let's say you see 5 to 10 candidates on the ballot. And this happens quite a bit, unfortunately, is that voters will pick 2 or 3 candidates on the first vote. And they fill it out wrong, so their vote is tossed right off the bat. They're thinking that you can pick, more than one candidate in the first round. So that's overvoting. That's a problem. That happens. And another one is voter exhaustion. Voter exhaustion is what I just described. Your vote eventually gets discarded unless you pick the final two candidates that are standing. That's exactly how ranked choice is used to identify who wins.
Yeah. There was an NPR story. I heard a Maine voter pointed out that we rank choices every day. She used the example of going out for ice cream. If your favorite flavor, Rocky Road, isn't available, you go for your second choice, pistachio. So how is ranking your preferences of candidates more complicated than ranking other choices that we have to make?
Well, remember, I said I'm a big fan of choices, but and I've heard that comparison. But what you're trying to describe is that voters are familiar with pistachio or vanilla or chocolate or Rocky Road or peppermint stick. They have they've tried those flavors and they know what they're like. The problem is that a lot of voters, if we're talking about ice cream, have never tried those flavors. And although it's noble to go and try each flavor or get to know each candidate, that's just not reality. You know, ranked choice would be for every single tire election for the most part. And it's going to add more confusion. So voters are going to go in the ballot box, and they're not going to have a good understanding of, you know, what those flavors of ice cream are or what the can stand for. So they're just going to guess. And even if they've tried all the ice cream or got to know all the different cans, it comes back to the problem of, did you pick the right cans that are still standing at the end? And one of the best ways I could describe this problem is, this may seem like forever ago, but do you remember this time last year we had about 20 candidates running in the Democrat primary for president? And a good majority of them were very serious candidates. They were governors and senators and high-profile congresspeople. So under ranked choice, you have to pick who would be the last two standing to ensure that your vote would count. And I would argue that even the smartest political scientists would have a hard time anticipating this time last year that Joe Biden would be one of the last two people standing. So unless you pick that right person under ranked choice, your vote does get discarded to find the majority who's still standing. So, you know, that's one of the biggest problems associated with the system.
Yeah. For years, we've had the two-party system, and our country is becoming more polarized along party lines. Independents and third-party candidates can't get a toehold because many Americans are concerned if they vote outside of the two-party system that they're throwing away their vote, as you say. Couldn't ranked choice voting be an opportunity to start dismantling the two-party system and bring more qualified candidates into public service?
So I will play a little devil's advocate there. So I think you are somewhat right with that. Let's just say, you know, like I said, full disclosure, I'm right of center. So I got a lot of friends that are conservatives or they're Republicans who may not like the president of the United States. They may not like Trump, and they consider themselves a never-Trumper. So when they go to vote in November, they're going to be conflicted. Do they vote for a libertarian candidate and throw their vote away, or do they vote for the president? Under ranked choice, they could vote for libertarian and then vote second for Donald Trump, knowing that the libertarian would never have a chance in actually winning. And it's just a protest vote, if you will. Under ranked choice, I could see that works. That's fine. But the problem is that, go back to that fourth congressional district, or go back to this time last year when you had 20 very strong Democrat candidates running for president. You can't throw that vote away because you got to pick who's going to be the last two people standing. If you pick wrong, your vote is gone. So under certain circumstances, I think ranked choice does have some limited merit, but the voters are just going to have to decide, is it enough to outweigh the cost? And I think the cost is that uncertainty of not knowing who the last two people are that's standing in any election. And of course, just overall confusion. You know, like you said, it's ice cream flavors, but unfortunately you gotta try each ice cream flavor and then rank it. And do people actually have that time and patience? I think it's a great, noble idea, but in reality, I just think people are too busy, especially this year with the era of COVID. Do we really want to add another burden to people? Let them go and just vote for whoever they think is best. And there's also some logistical problems with ranked choice. Sometimes you may go to vote and you don't like certain candidates. You just do not like them. Well, under ranked choice, you have to rank each person in order to have a chance to come out with the ability to maybe pick the right two that are still standing. But what happens if you really, really don't want to vote for one or two people? Well, then your vote will be discarded along the way. So there's some logistical problems with that, with ranked choice, where sometimes people may just want to vote for one or two people that they really like, or they just really don't want to vote for certain people.
All right. Let's talk to Sean, who's giving us a call from South Dartmouth. Good morning, Sean. Did you have a question for us or a comment? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, just a couple comments. So there were three points that I heard that I just would like to discuss. One, the last one, under ranked choice voting, you as a voter can vote for as many or as few. You can rank as many or as few candidates as you'd like. So the idea that you would be forced to put a ranking for a candidate you dislike is just not true. Like, you can continue to vote as you do now and vote for one candidate. So,
but that, Sean, then your vote would be discarded. That's just a fact.
Well, no,
if
but,
you don't
let's,
correctly
okay.
rank
let,
candidate,
to,
let's
just, let's
Paul,
just,
Paul, let him, Paul, let him finish it, and then you'll have a chance to respond. Let him finish. Go ahead, Sean.
Let's talk about, under the current system, your vote is for one candidate, and in the event that candidate is not the largest vote getter, you voted for your one candidate, right? So this idea of your vote not being counted, if you don't vote for the candidate that ends up as the winner, let's say in a primary, your vote counted toward the candidate that did not win.
Let me let Paul respond here, because we want to move on and we want to get the other side in as well on this. Sean, hold on in case you have more questions after. Paul, go ahead and respond to Sean.
So Sean said, you know, you can vote for as many or as few as you want. And again, that is not an inaccurate statement. But if you vote for as few candidates as you want, if you don't pick the last two candidates that are standing, your vote will be discarded. And that's the problem. Like I said, the story of, if you have candidates on the ballot that, you know, you may prefer just 2 out of 10, or you may really despise 2 out of 10. And under ranked choice, you got to rank them all in order for the best chance that you could have your vote counted. And if you don't, it's more likely your vote's going to get discarded throughout the process. Votes do get discarded under ranked choice. That's the only way to come out with a lower fake majority of the votes that are cast.
All right. Paul Carney is with the Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance, the group organized in opposition to question two, ranked choice voting. Paul, thanks for taking time to be with us. And now we hear from the group organized in support of question two, Evan Falchuk from Voter Choice for Massachusetts. Evan, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So, Evan, when I read the Secretary of the Commonwealth's pamphlet on question two, I have to admit it is confusing how candidates are eliminated and how votes are counted. So can you explain how the ranked choice voting would work as written in this proposal?
Yeah, it's actually quite simple. And I think your example of ranking ice creams is really good. But if you had three candidates running in a race, and say it's a Republican, a Democrat, and an independent, and you decided you wanted to vote for the independent candidate first and the Democrat second, and you didn't want to rank the Republican, and then they did the first count, and it was, you know, 40% for the Democrat and 35% for the Republican and 25% for the independent, the independent would be eliminated. And as a voter, if you voted for that independent, your second choice would now count. And they would get redistributed, and we'd see who ended up with the majority of the vote. So it's a very simple process that, as a voter, you would just have another row of bubbles to fill out, and you'd rank your candidates first, second, third, and so on.
So for voters who are concerned that the ballot would be confusing, how do you respond to that?
There's a ton of evidence, and ranked choice voting has been used in parts of the world for more than 100 years. And there's poll after poll and survey after survey that show that voters find it to be simple and easy. I'm not saying that it's automatically, you know, if you showed up tomorrow that you could snap your fingers and do it. But as soon as voters see it and understand it, it's quite clear. And this would become implemented in 2022. So we'd have about 2 years. But our organization over the last several years has been educating voters all across the Commonwealth. And we've got more than 6,000 volunteers working on this campaign. That, you know, when voters hear about it, they like it. And that's what polls show all around the country where ranked choice voting is used.
Yeah. Now, the Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance, as you probably just heard, says if voters guess wrong and vote for eliminated candidates, that their ballots are not counted in the final vote. Could that happen?
Well, it happens in the current system. It happens in the current system much, much worse than it would under ranked choice voting. So the fourth congressional district race that Paul was mentioning, the winner got 22% of the vote, which means that 78% of people had that happen to their ballot, using his definition. In ranked choice elections, the data show that ends up being you know, single-digit percentages. So, you know, with all the issues that Paul raised, those can happen, but you have to weigh that against the mountain of bad things that are happening in the current system. And one other thing is that, look, I think Paul is right that this is a good and noble cause. And I think that in America, there was a time in our country when we all wanted to work for good and noble causes, and ranked choice voting is just one of those ambitious, good, noble causes that make our democracy better.
So right now, our voting system counts the number of votes each candidate receives, and, you know, whomever gets the most votes is the winner. Under ranked choice voting, there could be many rounds of counting, and I suspect that this would not only be time-consuming, but could require new vote tabulation equipment. If so, where will the money come from to pay for these additional costs?
Well, first of all, it's actually a very limited amount of new upgrades that would need to happen. In Maine, they ran a ranked choice election where there were estimates it was going to cost millions of dollars. It actually ended up costing $120,000. We've worked closely with the Secretary of State's office. By the way, Secretary Galvin has endorsed question two. And we think that there'll be also a limited expense. There happened to be about $40 million in federal funds available for this as well. But the clerks across the Commonwealth are terrific professionals. We've been in touch with so many of them over the last few years, and I've got a lot of confidence in their ability to do this efficiently.
All right. Do we have Sean from South Dartmouth? Sean, are you still with us?
I am.
All right, Sean, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Well, the other point that I think Paul had raised was the idea of confusion. And I think when if you look at Maine, which adopted ranked choice voting, and then there was an effort to repeal it, and the voters had an opportunity, having used the system, to then vote whether they wanted to continue. And they voted to continue by greater margins than they had originally passed it, which would suggest not only that they're not confused, but that they like it.
All right, Sean, well, thank you for your call. We appreciate that. Evan, before we let you go, anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the great things about ranked choice voting is it gives you more choices. We find so many voters who feel like they are unable to, they need to pick between the lesser of two evils. And ranked choice voting means you can always vote for your hopes, not your fears. So if you want more information, we have a ton of it at the yesontorcv.com website. And we just look forward to earning everybody's vote for question two, vote yes on two.
Evan Falchuk is with Voters Choice for Massachusetts. Evan, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Great day. Take care.
Coming up after a break, we hear how ranked choice voting is playing out in the state of Maine. You're listening to The Point. We just heard from those in support of and in opposition to question two, ranked choice voting. If you'd like to share your thoughts with us or have a question, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Back in 2016, Maine voters were also asked to weigh in on ranked choice voting ballot question. It passed by 52% of the voters. Mal Leary is a political correspondent for Maine Public, who covered ranked choice voting when it was put before Maine voters, and we invited him here to talk us through how it's played out since its passed. Thanks for joining us, Mal.
Thank you.
So what were some of the arguments for and against ranked choice voting when it was on the Maine ballot in 2016?
Well, listening to your guests, it was the same things you heard this morning. I mean, there were folks who said it would be too confusing. There were other folks who looked upon it as a sweeping solution to a problem of electing folks to major public office without a majority vote. Maine doesn't have a runoff like you have in some states. So up until the ranked choice voting was implemented for federal races and state races, except the governor and sheriffs, which is interesting because in the Constitution, it spells out that they are elected by plurality. And in Maine, you can't change the Constitution by a citizen's initiative. You can change the law. So the citizen's initiative for ranked choice voting did that. It changed the items that could be changed. Voters, as you pointed out, supported it the first time around. They supported it again in an attempt to repeal it. And quite frankly, a lot of the concerns about it being confusing, played out as folks learned how this system worked. through efforts by the Secretary of State's office and by various public groups to inform them on how it works and how to fill out the ballot, and do, this is really not something to be afraid of. And it went on that we had the first member of Congress to be elected by ranked choice voting in the history of the country. And it was very interesting because the incumbent Republican in the first count led and had a plurality of the votes in the second congressional district. But when ranked choice voting was applied and the bottom two independent candidates who didn't have very many votes, but they had some, were removed and votes recounted on their second round, the Democrat, Jared Golden, won the seat. So we've had practical experience with it already in terms of the congressional race. And I think the reality is that despite the fears of people being confused, the polling data that I've looked at shows people are not that confused. They just take their time. And the options here may be a little different than what the Massachusetts law would be under the proposal you have before you. I think we cover more races. And the way it's set up, you know, you don't have to vote for every slot. For example, we have a four-way Senate race. Now, ranked choice voting is going to apply to that four-way Senate race. That doesn't mean you have to vote for four rounds of voting. It's your choice. You can go in and just vote for one person, and that's it. Or you can take the time and say, okay, on the second round, I'm going to vote for candidate B, and on the third round, I'm going to vote for candidate A. So to answer one of the questions that was brought up is, yes, indeed, it's confusing when you first implement it, but at least in Maine, folks adapted to it pretty quickly.
Yeah. So have there been increased costs associated with the different rounds of counting the ranked choice ballots?
There's been some costs. The second district, of course, is a congressional district, ranked choice voting, which meant collecting all those ballots from the entire second district. And I don't know if you look at geography, but the second district's the largest geographical district east of the Mississippi River. And they had to employ a lot of messengers to go get the ballots at the towns and bring them down to the Secretary of State's office to actually run the procedure. Because most races are still decided by simple majority. You don't have that many races. For example, this time around in the second district, it's a head-to-head race. So ranked choice voting will not have the chance to apply, even though it will in the Senate, where there are four candidates. So there is some additional costs. But that's, you know, as the supporters say, that's the cost of democracy. The whole idea is to provide voters with more choice, and that does cost some money.
So one of the goals of this was also to impact spending, campaign spending, and improve civility of campaigns. Have you seen that?
No. Absolutely not. The civility on campaigns is well, right now we're probably in one of the most bitter contests in the country in the United States Senate race. We have approaching, and you know, a lot of your listeners are going to know, you know, Maine's a pretty small state. We don't have a lot of TV markets, and spending has already reached $100 million by the two principal candidates, the Democrat and Republican, in the Senate race. I mean, it's outstanding, and the ads are all, no, I won't say they're all, but I would say 90% of the ads on both campaigns are negative, and some of them are really nasty ads, you know, where not only is the message harsh, but you look at the picture and you go, I don't know that person. Is that really Senator Collins, or is that really Speaker Gideon? My God, they look awful, because the photos being used in the ads have been doctored to look as worse, you know, presented as worse a picture as possible. So you have this whole image of negativity in the Senate race that is very hard for folks to believe unless they, you know, for example, come up and visit in Maine to go do some leaf sweeping and happen to watch some TV and go, my God, I can't watch television without 7 to 8 ads back-to-back, either for or against these two candidates for the Senate.
Yeah, and it's amazing how much of that money is coming from out of state, right?
Oh, overwhelmingly out of state. Out of state. And a lot of it is what's called the independent expenditures from political action groups. Some of it is disclosed, and some of it is dark money, where you don't know exactly where it's coming from, but you know it's being spent here. But the total amounts, so when you add them up on both sides, is just astronomical. It's not just the candidates raising and spending money. It's the independent expenditures in those races are just, you know, crazy. So the idea that somehow there's going to bring civility from this certainly hasn't applied in either of the races that we've had so far on ranked choice voting. It certainly wasn't that way 2 years ago in the congressional race, and this year it's just unreal, the negativity.
Yeah. Now, the Boston Globe had an article last Friday about ranked choice voting in Maine. And so I want to quote something from the article. It says, the experiment so far is totally incomplete, Ronald Schmidt Jr., a professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine, said of Maine's ranked choice voting, used first in June 2018 and slated for the first time to be applied to the presidential race in November. Maine could wind up being in the position of being an important early experience in ranked choice voting, but it can also wind up being this weird anomaly. What do you think about that?
I know Ron well. And that is the question mark. I mean, if you look at other countries, for example, Australia has used ranked choice voting for decades and have not had any sorts of outlier problems, if you will, in terms of their elections. Now, Ron's right. I mean, this could end up as to be a non-impact on races if you continue to have, for example, both of our congressional seats are simple, straightforward, but R versus D. There are no independents in the race, so there's no ability to implement ranked choice voting. There is in the U.S. Senate. There is, because after an unbelievable series of courts challenges and cases that went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, we will have ranked choice voting in the presidential race here in Maine this year. And where that's important isn't the state as a whole, but we are one of two states where we allocate our electoral votes by congressional district as well as at large for the entire state. And up in the second district in 2016, Donald Trump took the district by 10 points and took an electoral vote from Maine because of that, even though the state as a whole won for Hillary Clinton. They are making a big effort this time because they want to try to keep that single electoral vote, because if you look at some of the scenarios that have been played out nationally, you know, it could be that close. And they're going after every single vote they can. So the Trump campaign has been very much involved in the legal battles concerning ranked choice voting, and in fact were, you know, one of the reasons it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
It's going to be fascinating to watch, isn't it?
it's absolutely fascinating, and it's a policy question, though. You got to go back up a minute here. If the voters decide to do it, I mean, that's the policy.
Yeah.
And you can make the arguments, as you have heard, on both sides. But the bottom line is the voters decide.
Right. Mal Leary is political correspondent for Maine Public. Thanks so much for joining us and giving us your perspective, Mal. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
And if you missed any of this morning's conversation, you can catch it on our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.